Today is Tuesday, December 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the final phase of the U.S. House of Representatives impeachment process is getting underway. We take a look at that and what the White House strategy may be going forward.
As long as he maintains his base and those people do not break with the president, then the senators will think to themselves, well, it doesn't do me any good to break with the president if I'm running for re-election.
Plus, protests continue in India over a citizenship bill, and the first global refugee forum continues. Those stories and more are next. The U.S. House of Representatives Rules Committee is meeting to put forth the process the full House will follow when it considers articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump. Committee Chair James McGovern opened the session, highlighting its importance.
No one should be allowed to use the powers of the presidency to undermine our elections or cheat in a campaign, no matter who it is and no matter what their party. We all took an oath. Not to defend a political party, but to uphold the Constitution of the United States. History is testing us. We can't control what the Senate will do, but each of us can decide whether we pass that test, whether we defend our democracy, and whether we uphold our oath.
Ranking Republican member Tom Cole called the process that led members here biased.
It is, as you referenced, Mr. Chairman, a sad day. Sad day for me personally. For the Rules Committee, for the institution of the House, and for the American people. We're meeting today on a rule for considering articles of impeachment against a sitting President of the United States on the floor of the House of Representatives. This is not the result of a fair process and certainly not a bipartisan one. Sadly, the Democrats' impeachment inquiry has been flawed and partisan from day one.
The procedural step will set the stage for what is widely expected to be a vote down nearly party lines on Wednesday, with the majority of Democrats approving Trump's impeachment over the objections of lawmakers from his Republican Party. Now, to take us through the start of this final phase of what's taking place in the House is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So we've heard about the Intelligence Committee, the Oversight Committee, the Judiciary Committee. This is the Rules Committee. So what exactly is their function in this impeachment process?
So the Rules Committee is pretty much our last stop in our, what you have said, tour of House committees through this entire impeachment process. And the purpose of the Rules Committee is to really prepare the debate for when that legislation comes up on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives and the entire U.S. House of Representatives gets to vote on it. They're kind of setting the ground rules for how long each side will be able to debate it tomorrow when they get ready for that vote.
Is there any indication of what both sides are kind of asking for in the Rules Committee? Because when we look back to the Judiciary Committee and approving those two articles of impeachment, those were marathon sessions.
You're very right about that. So when we were in the Judiciary Committee, we were actually marking up the text itself. This is a little bit of a different process where they're deciding how long exactly the floor debate will go. Now, I can expect that Republicans will be arguing that every member should get their say on an issue of such grave importance as impeachment. Democrats, of course, will also want to hold open a lot of time for this. But remember that we're running out of time up here on Capitol Hill. We have 3 days left in session after today, a number of big-ticket legislative items. Members want to leave town for the holiday break. Everything is coming down to the wire here.
You mentioned the ticking clock, and Mr. Collins on the Republican side calls this a campaign of the Democrats against the clock and calendar. What do we expect in terms of a timeline tomorrow? When will these debates begin?
Well, we're actually going to be finding that out as they set these ground rules today in the House Rules Committee. What you can expect is that the impeachment vote will probably be later on in the day because we're going to get so much floor debate on that issue. And then once that happens, of course, then that does go over to the U.S. Senate, where Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that they will begin that Senate impeachment trial, the second step of the impeachment process, early next year.
Catherine Gibson reports for VOA from Capitol Hill. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
U.S. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell appeared to reject a request from the Senate's top Democrat to call new witnesses in that expected impeachment trial. McConnell called the House Democrats' case deficient and thin against the president. Meanwhile, the White House is shifting its focus to the Republican-led Senate, where the president will face the trial as early as January, as Catherine said. VOA's Patsy Wita-Kuswara has this story on how the Trump administration and his allies are planning to mount a fast and aggressive defense with the goal of turning the tables on the opposition Democrats.
December is usually a time for holiday parties and cheer. Instead, the White House is gearing up for a battle.
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye.
This week, the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives is expected to vote to impeach President Donald Trump on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Trump will face trial in the Senate, where Democrats demand to hear from more witnesses, including acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
They might present exculpatory evidence that helps President Trump. It may be incriminating against the president, but they should be heard.
So far, the White House strategy has been to stonewall and call the House investigations a sham partisan process, which has been effective in maintaining support from Trump's base. Todd Belt is a professor at George Washington University.
As long as he maintains his base and those people do not break with the president, then the senators will think to themselves, well, it doesn't do me any good to break with the president if I'm running for re-election.
Now that the process is moving to the Republican-led Senate, the White House strategy is shifting. They are now working with top Republicans to move the trial quickly and limit political damage.
I've heard Mitch. I've heard Lindsay. I think they are very much in agreement on some concept. I'll do whatever they want to do. It doesn't matter.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pledged total coordination with the administration. Critics accuse him of violating the duty to be impartial. Vanderbilt University Professor Vanessa Beasley.
That's a strategy that's worked well for McConnell in the past, to go ahead and signal his allegiances, signal what he's going to do and what he's not going to do. So he's betting that that's in fact what Republicans want to have him do and want to hear him say right now.
Another strategy, continue to attack Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden as corrupt for allowing his son to be on the board of a Ukrainian energy company when he was vice president. The accusations may be hurting Biden.
But you, on the other hand, sent your son over there to get a job and work for a gas company.
Joe Biden dismisses demands that he testify in Trump's impeachment trial as a ploy to divert attention. Patsy Wita-Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Meanwhile, President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is laying out his role in ousting America's former top diplomat in Ukraine. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has this story.
Rudy Giuliani's portraying himself as directly involved in bumping Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, and he's giving details indicating how much the president knew. Giuliani tells the New York Times he gave information to the president about how Yovanovitch was getting in the way of investigations that could politically benefit the president, who in turn passed the information to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Weeks later, Yovanovitch was ordered home to the U.S. Giuliani says both the president and Pompeo relied on his information, telling the Times he simply gave them the facts. If it was up to him, Giuliani says, quote, "If I was Attorney General, I would have kicked her out. I mean, Secretary of State." Sagar Magani at the White House.
Pakistan has sentenced former dictator General Pervez Musharraf to death in a treason case, but it's possible the punishment will never be carried out. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The case relates to the state of emergency Musharraf had imposed in 2007 when he placed several key judges under house arrest. He came to power after ousting former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in a 1999 bloodless coup. Now, this is the first time in the nation's history that a former army chief and ruler of the country has been sentenced to death. Sentenced in absentia, Musharraf has been out of the country since 2016 when he was allowed to leave on bail to seek medical treatment abroad, and he's unlikely to return. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Indian students' protests that turned into violent clashes with police galvanized opposition nationwide on Tuesday to a new law that provides a path to citizenship for non-Muslim migrants who entered the country illegally from several neighboring countries. Police fired tear gas Tuesday in the Sialampur area of New Delhi to push back protesters who swarmed toward the barricades and threw stones. Protests were also reported in the states of West Bengal, Kerala, and Karnataka, and elsewhere as well. For more on the nearly week-long series of protests, I spoke with reporter Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
This new citizenship bill changes India's 64-year-old citizenship law, which used to prohibit illegal migrants from becoming Indian citizens. Now, effectively, illegal migrants from religious groups such as Hindus, Christians, and Sikhs can become citizens, and this only covers three countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. However, Muslims cannot. The government says Muslims have been excluded because they are not minorities in the three countries that the law covers. However, there are fears that, you know, this is really an anti-Muslim bill by a government which is seen as a Hindu nationalist government.
So what really tapped into the protesters who are, in some cases, being fired upon by tear gas to quell the unrest?
Absolutely. There have been a lot of protests. They happened in the northeast of the country where the army was put on standby and the police fired tear gas shells and lathis to quell the protests. It happened again in a university campus in New Delhi, and that has really created an outcry because the police allegedly entered the campus, beat up protesters. Some people say they were even fired upon. Of course, that is not confirmed. The police say they used maximum restraint, but about 50 people at least were wounded. Again, there was a protest today in a Muslim neighborhood in the capital where, again, there were stone-throwing crowds, buses were damaged.
Given the number of protests that have taken place this past week, what has been the government response to the protesters' demands and comments saying that this is an anti-Muslim bill?
The government absolutely denies it. It says it is not an anti-Muslim bill. Prime Minister Modi has said that the new law is for those who have no place to go except India, you know, it's because it covers Hindus, and says, as I said earlier, Muslims have been excluded because they're not minorities. Mr. Modi says that, you know, it is his political rivals who are trying to mislead students and who are trying to stir up protests, and he dismisses it, these protests, as entirely political. So I don't think the government is really looking to back down on the law. So several political commentators and several editorials are asking the government to re-examine the law in the light of the protests that are taking place.
Well, you bring this up. There's been calls for the government to re-examine that. What are you hearing in New Delhi about the rationale for not re-examining the bill?
Well, you know, the Prime Minister of this government has a huge majority in Parliament. The bill passed easily. There was very little opposition to it, simply for the reason that there are very few people on the opposition benches, especially in the lower house of Parliament. Mr. Modi is a pretty strong leader, determined to push ahead with whatever agenda he has, and most people feel he will not back down because he has the numbers behind him, the parliamentary numbers.
Is there any indication about how long these protests may last?
That's very hard to say. It depends. Because there were protests at one university campus, what we saw yesterday was that they snowballed to a number of campuses across the country. But of course, we're coming into the holiday season, so the campus protests may wind down. However, street protests led by opposition leaders in various states which are not ruled by the BJP are likely to continue for some time to come.
Anjana Pasricha reports out of New Delhi. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
French union activists cut electricity to nearly 100,000 homes or offices. Eiffel Tower staff also walked off the job. Even Paris opera workers joined in Tuesday's nationwide protest across France, singing an aria of anger as workers rallied against the government's plan to raise the retirement age to 64. Despite 13 days of crippling train and subway strikes, French President Emmanuel Macron and his government have stayed firm. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. The World Health Organization says the emergence and rapid growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, known as superbugs, are a serious worldwide health concern. Most scientists have placed the blame in the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the overuse of antibiotics to treat both humans and livestock for various ailments. New research conducted by British and Spanish scientists have found evidence that cigarette smoke can cause MRSA superbug strains to become even more resistant to antibiotics. The researchers found that the cigarette smoke stresses MRSA superbugs. The stress causes the already antibiotic-resistant bacteria to send out emergency signals, which increases the rate of mutation in microbial DNA that produces robust and tenacious variants that can better resist antibiotics. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Statues, seafood, and textiles were proposed exports to be taken off the North Korean sanction list on Monday. Reuters' Ryan Brooks reports.
China and Russia proposed lifting some UN sanctions on North Korea Monday. That's according to a draft resolution to the UN Security Council seen by Reuters. Russia says the move is meant to help along talks between Pyongyang and Washington. It would take North Korean statues, seafood, and textiles off the sanctions list. All of those industries are moneymakers for the North, targeted by the UNSC to cut off funds for the country's nuclear program. The North was famous for selling huge socialist-style statues overseas, mainly to Africa, and it's made millions from seafood. However, a U.S. State Department official told Reuters now isn't the time to end sanctions. The North threatening to escalate tensions and nuclear talks on ice. In recent weeks, Pyongyang's carried out a series of weapons tests and has put a year-end deadline for the U.S. to make concessions in talks. And on Monday, Pentagon Chief Mark Esper said more tests may be likely.
It's a concern, their rhetoric. We have seen talk of tests. I think that may well be likely if they don't feel satisfied. So I'm familiar with their tactics, with their bluster, and I think we need to get serious and sit down and have discussions about a political agreement that denuclearizes the peninsula. That is the best way forward and arguably the only way forward.
As for the Security Council, it's not clear when or if the draft resolution to lift sanctions could see a vote. It would need 9 out of 15 votes to pass, plus no vetoes from the U.S. or allies Britain and France.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. General Charles Q. Brown, the commander of the U.S. Air Forces and the Indo-Pacific Command, told reporters that Washington expects North Korea to follow through on its promise for some sort of Christmas gift for President Trump. He said he expects it to be a launch of some type of long-range ballistic missile, but was unsure if it would come Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, or after the start of the new year. The impact of Boeing's decision to suspend production of its 737 MAX is spreading. The AP's Mike Heppen explains.
The ramifications of not producing the jet are likely to ripple beyond aviation and manufacturing sectors and could alter the country's trade balance. Southwest Airlines and American Airlines have pushed back any hope of reinserting the MAX into their lineups until April. The Federal Aviation Administration has not given a specific date for approving the MAX's return. Boeing has announced it will suspend production of the MAX starting sometime in January, with no specific date for when production will resume. I'm Mike Hempen.
More than 100 companies and foundations are committing their time, money, and business acumen to help many of the world's 25 million refugees find jobs, get an education, and become contributing residents to their countries of exile. Lisa Schlein reports representatives of these organizations are among the more than 2,000 representatives from all sectors of society attending the first Global Refugee Forum.
More than 100 companies and foundations are committing their time, money, and business acumen to help many of the world's 25 million refugees find jobs, get an education, and become contributing members of their countries of exile. Representatives of these organizations are among more than 2,000 representatives from all sectors of society attending the first ever Global Refugee Forum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the meeting in Geneva. The forum has gotten off to a good start. The UN Refugee Agency reports that more than 30 organizations, including multinationals and small and medium-sized enterprises, have pledged more than $250 million to help transform the lives of refugees and the communities hosting them. When the refugee crisis hit Europe in 2016, multinational retailer IKEA committed itself to providing employment to many of the refugees who had no means of support. Tolga Onsu, CEO of IKEA's Inca Group, says his organization pledges to scale up this program. He says IKEA plans to support 2,500 refugees through job training and language skills in 300 of its stores in 30 countries by 2022. He says this action will help the refugees and the company's bottom line.
It is good business to do good, and we at IKEA have the fortune to think in generations. Say, there is another part where we are committing to do, and that is to participate in changing the narrative in the societies around refugees. We want this narrative to be a positive narrative.
The Vodafone Foundation runs high-quality education programs for refugee children in camps in Kenya, Tanzania, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. It says it plans to expand these programs to encompass more than 500,000 young refugees in new countries by 2025. The Lego Foundation also values the opportunities education offers refugee children. Its CEO, John Goodwin, says this year the foundation is awarding $100 million to a consortium led by the International Rescue Committee to help host governments improve the educational outcomes for 800,000 pre-primary and primary school children living in refugee settings in East Africa.
We'll be doing this through supporting 10,000 educators and 170,000 caregivers, all of whom are going to receive training and professional development on how to engage in learning through play with children who find themselves in these adverse circumstances.
Goodwin says the Lego Foundation is focusing on East Africa because of the region's largely forgotten long-standing refugee crisis. He says many people there have been displaced for upwards of 30 years, and his organization wants to help children in this environment have a better start in life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australian firefighters warned that they would not be able to contain some of the brush fires there. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports that there have been calls to address the issue on a national level.
It looks like hell on earth. Some 100 bushfires still raging in Australia. Firefighters there warned on Tuesday they would not be able to contain some of the blazes. They also expect conditions to worsen later this week.
Everything we can.
Rob Rogers, a fire official in New South Wales, warned locals near existing fires that the inferno could spread.
But by no means people should underestimate the potential for how bad these days can be. Saturday looks like potentially the worst day, but Thursday will be bad enough. So people need to just brace themselves.
Critics have tried to make Prime Minister Scott Morrison feel the heat too. They say he's not done enough to address the impact of climate change. Protesters last week in Sydney rallied by the thousands, and former fire chiefs from across the country are calling on Morrison to step up and for a national summit. Greg Mullins is among them.
It's no good saying that we're only a small emitter of carbon dioxide. It's simply not true. Amongst about 200 countries, we're number 17. When we add in the coal that we sell to other countries, we come up to about number 5. Other countries were aghast that while Australia burns, our government went over there and argued against tougher emission standards. This has to change, so the summit that we call will deal with bushfires, natural disasters and other emergencies, but also with that underlying issue of climate change.
The fires have killed 6 people, destroyed more than 680 homes, and burned nearly 3 million acres of bushland. Temperatures across parts of the eastern state of New South Wales are expected to top 40 degrees Celsius on Wednesday.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Jackson Vunganyi, engineer Nashwan Kale, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.